So SEO and ASO, App Store Optimization, like I don't want to nerd out with too many silly marketing acronyms, and I'll try to be sensitive to the listener here, but...
You have to justify your role here. It's okay to have some acronyms.
Yeah, that's right. That's how we dizzy people. We just use as many as possible. Exactly. And
that's what doctors do.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. Learn more about Optimove by requesting a demo at optimove.com/businessofbetting. And if you like what you see, you will get your first month free.
What is up, everybody? I am Jason Trost, the host of the Business of Betting podcast. Today is episode 206, and I am joined with James McLaughlin out of Australia, I believe, who's been around the betting industry for a while, has a lot of experience, namely in Australia, but has also been to the States and has opinions galore. If you follow him on LinkedIn, he's probably one of the most, him and Chris Grove probably fight for who can give the most LinkedIn posts on sports betting. So if you want to see a real-time feed of what's in James' brain, please subscribe to his LinkedIn feed. So welcome to the podcast, James.
Thank you, Jason. Yeah, lovely to be here. And thank you for the introduction. I do get a little creative, a little bit of a brain dump on there, but I love expressing myself on LinkedIn and I appreciate the shout out. And Chris Grove is obviously in very good company to be compared there.
Well, you express yourself very well. So why don't we kick off? You have specialized more on the marketing side of sports betting, even though you've been around the industry for quite some time with, Betfair and Sportsbet in Australia. I've always been one that have called the big betting companies marketing companies and have sort of maligned them as saying they're shit products, shit at technology, but really good at marketing and really good at brand and experience. So why don't we kick off there? Like, do you agree with that thesis or do you think I am smoking something?
I would challenge it a little bit. I think that the DraftKings and FanDuel, at FanDuel in particular, I think that they've been quite strong in the product. I think that's what different, well, they differentiated themselves because they tipped so much money into their fantasy product, you know, before sports betting existed and had that national brand awareness. DraftKings similarly. And I think DraftKings actually investing in product helped them catch up to the early lead that FanDuel had. But FanDuel, I think, based itself, you know, with a lot of Australian staff and was operating, a lot of the team was out of Melbourne originally. The Sportsbet product, which is, you know, Flutter's sister company, dominated the Australian market by actually being quite clever with personality and marketing, to your point, and was really personality-led business. But I think that they kept investing in product and kept really getting stronger and stronger. And I think that when the US market opened, as well as the national brand awareness that they had, I think that they executed much better. I don't know if you were, you know, trying to have a place of bet in Jersey and stuff when it first opened, Jason, but that experience on FanDuel was so much crisper and easier. And DraftKings wasn't quite there, but it caught up, in my opinion. Whereas BetMGM and Caesars and some of these other products that were live early, there was their bet compliant, just the lag and the navigation was really weak. And I feel like that a strength of those Flutter products is actually the product is why they have had such success, plus billions of dollars in marketing and every head start you can possibly have.
So what would happen if you turned off the billions of marketing and just went for organic growth? Would FanDuel go to zero or what do you think would happen?
I mean, now they've literally spent billions of dollars in brand awareness that doesn't go anywhere, right? They've been spending hundreds of millions of dollars every year since, I don't know, 2015, 2014. I don't know the exact timeline when this started. So you kind of can't undo that. But if you were sort of erasing them from the start right now and the market was opening, I still feel like I love DraftKings. I think was the best product that I used to use betting regularly in the US. I was living in New York for 18 months and flying to new states and routing opening promotions and using product pretty significantly across every state line. And I thought the DraftKings product was actually the strongest, followed by FanDuel. And then there was a significant gap. So I feel like they're going to continue that momentum because they tick those boxes too.
So to summarize, you're kind of disagreeing with my premise. You think it's both. You think it's product and marketing experience.
I do. Yeah. I think that I've got, like, just in terms of the live betting models, the range of product. And I think understanding that new customer has been what they've done too, by just having, you know, a really simple, easy parlay experience that's player prop focused. I think that was kind of the difference at the time. And that keep evolving to match the market, I think, personally. I mean, the Price Picks and Underdog, you know, the DFS product, I think, you know, being available in more states and just being even simpler. There's a case that could be made that that product starting at the same starting line would be as successful. I'm not sure. I feel like that, yeah, I'd make a pretty strong case that the DraftKings and FanDuel product would still win because it's better than betting on BetMGM, Caesars, and the other products, I think.
So when I say these companies are bad at product, I think I'm largely referring, not just the user, not principally the user experience. I'm largely focusing on price, you know, the odds that
right.
people actually get.
Yes.
Because at its core, that is the product, even though there's the sort of the Jamie Foxx holding a football or whatever. At the end of the day, you're trying to make a trade on yep. a sport. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think a lot of these products fall down because I don't think they're very good at pricing. I don't think that the technology to be good at pricing. What is your opinion in your experience? Like, do customers care about price? Is that, do customers think that that's an essential part of the product, or are they more interested in Jamie Foxx and the right sort of logo when they're placing a bet?
It's a great question. I think like when I was at Betfair leading the growth and focusing on acquisition there for maybe 4 years out in Australia, that was our main message, right? It was like price, best odds. And that's what we would try to communicate. And it would only go so far. And I feel like it's even weaker of a message now. I feel like the market, sadly, to you and me who are sort of purists and like to take the best odds and beat the market, sadly, I think that the new customer just wants the lotto ticket. It's just entertainment. They want the six-leg parlay that, you know, has so much fat and margin in it that you and I, it makes us sick that people like that product. But that's, to me, I think where the evolution has gone. And then there's still a place for your matchbooks, your smarkets, your Betfairs, and the crypto ones that are going to start up and offer a similar super tight margin, particularly when the markets are liquid, which, as you know, is a challenge of exchanges. But that product's always going to exist. But I think that the demand for that is significantly smaller than I just want to get on with my, I want to bet the Mahomes overs, the Kelce touch, you know, catches, the touchdowns, the total points. That parlay is, I think, is going to continue being more popular.
I agree with that, but there's nothing written in the rules of physics that say parlays have to be horrible margin for the customer. You know, if DraftKings pays 90-1, you know, maybe the true value is 150-1 or
yeah.
something like that. So there's, you know, they don't have to be high margin. So I think there's not really a low margin provider of bet builders and same game parlays that there is, you know,
yeah,
maybe the singles market, but.
Well, let me flip it to you. Do you think that that would be successful? Do you think that people would, that customer would identify that product is better and that there's less fat in that and that I should be using that?
Well, ultimately, yes, because that's what I built my business around. So I have to prove my opinion right and do everything to have myself have the right opinion. But to me, I've thought about this a lot, and I think there's a few issues at play. One, I think humans, evolutionary-wise, are horrible at understanding probability. You know, we had to know if we're going to get eaten by the lion or not, but we didn't know what the chance of rain was tomorrow. We need to know big things, right? That's why our fight or flight response is so sharp, but our ability to detect subtleties and probability is not very sharp. So I think that's sort of a backdrop. The second thing is, even as somebody within the industry, I find it incredibly hard to compare prices. There are sort of the odds comparison websites out there that make it a little bit easier, but even they're quite a faff to kind of find the market and go to the market. So I think part of the issue is it's just so hard. You know, whenever you buy a plane ticket now, you go to one of the aggregators and they make it super easy. Or you want to go to a hotel, you see this Marriott's 200, this Hilton is 300, and it's really easy. But when you want to go bet on a parlay, first of all, it probably took you, unless you're doing a pre-rolled parlay, took you probably 5 minutes to boot it up. And then it's really hard to do a price comparison of that. So I think that's the core issue. Not that people aren't price sensitive, but that it's actually quite hard to do a comparison. I think if you saw the DraftKings price and the SBK price, for example, and let's say SBK was way better, I think people would want the better price, all things being equal.
Yep. No, I agree.
So, like, I mean, we're a small company. We haven't spent $100 million of dollars per year on brand marketing.
Yeah.
We probably spend $1 million a year on brand marketing, something like that. So like, what would your advice be to the little guys in the market? You know, there's probably like 20 little guys trying to make it in the sports betting world, whether it's the European, I'm not very familiar with the Australian market, but if you want to tie it into the UK market or to the American market, what would your advice be?
It's tough, obviously, just trying to be lean, and really you need to explore as many channels as possible. And The challenge with that too, when you've got a modest budget, is you really need the analytics to be plugged in, which is a whole new thing, just in terms of you getting your software and having people in your team that can manage the return on your ad spend. But yeah, you really just need to sprinkle across as many different places as possible and see what works. So it might be, you know, some YouTube sponsorship. You might work with some influencers that you're doing some pre-roll and in-content ads there, or you might be playing around with Twitter and doing some Twitter advertising, which is obviously a prominent social channel for the betting community. There are so many different ways to try to spend money. I love at the moment really leaning into app store marketing. I feel like that's the most efficient that I work with. I work with clients in the UK, US and Australia, and that's easily the most efficient channel that I manage. And again, like I've got a background in acquisition of across all the different channels. I just enjoy that. And one of the big parts of it that's super frustrating for most businesses, but particularly small to medium sized ones, is the working with Facebook and Google to get approvals and keep those licenses and not having ads be flagged. Like, it's so time demanding and really takes away the momentum of businesses. So that's a big frustration as well, just having those licenses to be able to try and advertise on as many channels as possible. But I particularly love short form video, which has obviously been trending for a few years now, but trying to focus on the niche and the strengths of your product. Like, for example, if I was trying to help out the SmartKit teams at the moment, I would be really leaning into your politics markets and the stuff with your really crisp data visualization. So I would be leaning into those and expressing those on as many sort of social platforms as I can and integrating it into short form video with a bit of opinion. But there's so many different ways to do marketing these days that it can be fatiguing and challenging. But my advice normally is to play around in as many different channels as possible, have the analytics plugged in and see what works, and obviously triple down on what does and pull out of what doesn't. And probably after you do that, don't spread yourself too thin where you're trying to do everything. Run some tests to have a few of those channels that are humming and working better, and just lean into those. And you should, you know, two or three channels. That'd be my advice.
So this is not my world at all, and I apologize to the listeners that know all this stuff, but I might be asking some really dumb questions. So I never realized that App Store marketing could be a niche, and in your words, it's the most efficient use of advertising dollars for this industry. So whenever I go to download an app, I would say 99.99999% of the time, I know what I want to download already. How many people are actually persuaded by an ad and download something they didn't want to download?
It's a great question. If you ask an Apple representative, they'd probably tell you 20-30% is kind of what they try to quote, is how you can sort of take a user off track in terms of their branded search. But there are a lot of non-branded searches as well. I use a lot of third-party tools, or two in particular, that give me the search data, and just generic terms like best betting app or sports betting or horse racing. If you can rank prominently for those positions where they're non-branded searches, people are actually having a not, you know, that customer journey does exist where people are curious. Hey, or you can be taken down a different path. I know what the first foray into me sort of deep diving into this was looking at the data of Prize Picks and Underdog and seeing how prominently they bid on each other's terms, but how effective it was at taking people away from that journey. Obviously, in that particular time, this was a couple of years ago, where they were the two clear options for that product, you might download both. So you might just grab both of those products, sign up with both and see which experience you enjoy better. What really tipped me into that, this marketing channel as something that was successful, is I had some analytics that showed me how effective it was for Underdog and Prize Picks. And forgive me, I don't remember the data, but I know it was bigger than 20% of their total download was from advertising on the competitors' branded terms.
So as you were saying that, I want to retract my 99.99% statement, because I remember I wanted a Sudoku app and I didn't know which one. So I searched Sudoku and I think I've searched for like a cooking app. I searched for a light meter app. I searched a VPN app. So I take that back. I did search for things and was looking for things organically. How does these two analytic companies, I don't know if you want to name check them or not. These two analytic companies, how did they get the data? Because Apple is famously a walled garden.
Yeah, I couldn't answer that very well. Mobile Action and AppTweak are what I use. I know that they're plugged into a lot of products. Like, they're two of the most popular third-party mobile advertising platforms. And I don't know, I presume as a customer that's plugged in, because you get sort of incentivized when using their software to plug in your own Apple Store Connect and your search ads platform, so you can get better reporting and dashboards that they might be sort of pirating your stuff and using it to feed their machines and their algorithms to determine the search volumes of different terms. But yeah, I'm not sure how they do it. I'm sure, and the data is inconsistent across both, but there is a consistency in terms of the terms and the search volume. Just like the total volume, the numbers are always different, but the proportions are normally pretty accurate.
When you're working for a client, are you also doing SEO optimization? Because you were talking about ranking for search terms, or are you paying to rank on those search terms?
So SEO and ASO, App Store Optimization, like I don't want to nerd out with too many silly marketing acronyms, and I'll try to be sensitive to the listener here, but
you have to justify your role here. It's okay to have some acronyms.
Yeah, that's right. That's how we dizzy people. We just use as many as possible.
Exactly. That's what doctors do.
Yeah, that's right. So search engine optimization is obviously for searching on Google and being in DuckDuckGo and ranking for those, whether it's on web or on mobile. But App Store optimization is the terms that are used within searching on either your Android phone or your Apple phone. And you can influence where you rank for those terms based on many different factors. One being advertising for certain terms. If you pay Apple, they'll rank you high for terms. It just naturally improves your organic positioning.
Funny that.
Yeah, that's right. And if you're quite frequent with the keyword, so you should be intentional about the keyword. So for you, for example, it's markets, you'd be using Bet Exchange and anything exchange, best odds, there'd be a lot of stuff that you're trying to proliferate in your copy is using, being very specific and intentional with the language you use, that helps. But then there's another little gray-hatted trick where you can actually use some agencies that can move you up the list by replicating the user journey of searching for Bet Exchange and downloading Smarkets. And you can do that. You can pay a little agency to replicate that with, you know, dozens of users that are UK located and populate that way, which is an efficient
way. The dark arts.
That's exactly right. So there are a few different levers and I try to use most of them.
Got it. And then you said that you had a lot better luck with this than Facebook, Google. Like Facebook, Google are the giants of online advertising. You know, before you said that, I would assume that they're the best places to advertise, like a lot of people, just because they're infinitely scalable and maybe the efficiency drops off, but at least you have infinite opportunity to target different audiences and geographies. So can you expand a little bit about that? And what's the sort of relative size in terms of ad budgets for companies, or what's the ad market size, app store marketing versus traditional?
I wish I had that data. I would guess it's in the 10 to 20% sort of range, but I think it's becoming a lot more prominent, particularly in our space. But I see a lot of success with Facebook. That's still a really popular channel, you know, delivering ads, whether it's video often on Instagram and using the WhatsApp deliverables. Obviously, as these companies get bigger and buy other places where they can distribute your advertising, super effective. With Google, I find YouTube ads and their video ads being the most efficient way to use money. I really don't think that particularly in gambling, I find that the search ads and how Google started its advertising business and just having, you know, four different competitors above the branded term of the company that someone's searching for, I don't find that very efficient. I feel like that has cost a lot for the last couple of years. That's not a really great place to advertise. But again, I see, depending on who you are and what your skill set is, but I work with some businesses that are exceptional at Facebook advertising. You know, I can't get the same results. That's not something that I live and breathe in. There are particular formulas that I've seen that work really well across that medium. But like I was saying at the start, if you're looking to be successful with your acquisition marketing, you need a few channels. And Facebook as well as App Store marketing might be the only two that you need.
Got it. Before we move on to that, I just want to ask a real question. Like, what is a good download to account created conversion ratio look like? You know, is it 10, 20% or what's success look like?
Yeah, great question. I look at the conversion rate twice, basically from converting from seeing your ad and clicking into it. And so clicking on your listing on the App Store and downloading it, if you can do above 45% on that, that's really strong. And you can influence that by your user review, obviously having really nice creative that's going to help improve that, and some strong reviews and your average score plus some strong creative, that's going to improve that. And 45% or up is really strong for a non-branded term. So that's me looking up, betting app, seeing SBK and downloading it. If I can do that at 45% or greater, that's excellent. If I'm looking for SBK, I want to be downloading it above 75% as a conversion rate. Then once I've got that download and I want someone to open an account and deposit into it, anything above 35% I think is really strong. And you kind of around 30, I think normally costs in, but when your funnel is a lot leakier after that, it makes the whole you really have to repair that first. There's no point spending money in on any of your advertising mediums. I don't believe if you're converting at 20, 15, 10%, you really need to improve that, whether it's incentivizing users or asking less questions. And that's where that sort of product lens on things is really important, because that's where a lot of businesses can falter. And I know at Betfair, we used to be really weak at that, just that user experience and asking too many questions and having it really slow. Like, you really need to keep that momentum.
Pivoting to betting exchanges, I believe you were at Betfair Exchange Australia for 2-3 years, correct?
Yeah, 3 or 4 years. Yep.
So what is your take on why exchanges haven't kind of taken over? I would say, if anything, they're sort of retreating from the popular landscape in sports betting.
Yeah, I think similar to our discussion before, I think that the market evolved, and I'll just speak to the Australian product. It doesn't really serve that user anymore. So if I'm looking to have a first goal scorer parlay into that team winning, which has just become such a trendy product, I think that's also user education has been influenced by those leading sports books in Australia, that being Sportsbet, Ladbrokes. They incentivize and educate customers to use that product, and the exchange doesn't have that. And particularly new users and younger users that get into it, by not being able to have the functionality to easily create that product and having liquidity on the other side of that, makes it really difficult, I think, to service that product. And, you know, if you've got less groceries on the shelf, for example, it's like you're shopping at a deli instead of going to Costco. You're giving the users less of the product that they're after. And again, I think that they're becoming desensitized to price odds. So you've just got less compelling reasons to be used. And I feel like the price sensitive customers are often older and been in the game a lot longer versus the new wave of customers are less sensitive to it.
Got it. So you kind of, if I were to read into your opinion just there, you would say that betting exchanges will continue to be a niche and probably shrink over time.
Yeah, that's my belief.
Would you say that's fair? I mean, that's why we created SBK. My hypothesis was that whether or not you're a bookie or an exchange, like, you ultimately will want your prices derived from an exchange. It doesn't have to be a customer-facing exchange, but I think you, at some point, you want market dynamics and fast updating prices and all these kinds of things. And I can't see how you can be a next tier sportsbook without having an exchange backend. So to me, I think it's, you know, exchanges will always be around, but I do agree that they've, you know, and I would knock ourselves on this, that we haven't done enough to kind of keep up with consumer trends, at least on the exchange side. And I think all the exchanges have been shrinking the last couple of years in terms of volume and reach.
Yeah, I think the player product component of it too is really hard. The player prop, sorry, is that that's just such a huge niche across the industry and has been for a few years. People want to bet on LeBron. They don't want to bet on the Lakers. And having, you know, so many different options, you know, there's so many markets on your sports bet and your FanDuel and your DraftKings that it's really hard for an exchange to keep up with that and have, you know, they offer all those products with tons of margin into it because they don't have the exchange to fall back on or Pinnacle to use as a barometer for what the market odds should be.
Yet. We're going to work on that.
Not.
So speaking of things that exchanges are good at, which is political markets, I know you're a fan of political markets. What's your take on the political world vis-a-vis betting markets and Trump and all these kinds of things?
I get very excited by it because when I was at Betfair in 2016 and 2020, the market was enormous and the momentum that built towards November was just a pure market perspective and seeing the exchange in its vibrant best and seeing all this opinion. And I saw that also on some big Mayweather and McGregor fights and stuff like that, like really big events just makes the exchange such a juicy place to follow. And obviously it's, you know, that weight of money tells you what's likely going to happen. Trump's had that X factor. I was heavily invested in Biden in 2020. And that was, I think I've never sweated as much as watching the market fluctuations that were taking place in that. That was, I think I swore myself off betting about 5 times while I was watching Trump over index versus the market's expectations. His X factor and just his ability to, love him or hate him, he is tension personified. And I think that that'll make the 2024 election as fascinating as ever. And the Biden Trump and the Trump Hillary markets were, as far as I'm aware, the two biggest betting events globally ever. Certainly judging by the Betfair's weight of money across the exchange. It's just such a fascinating market that I love to watch. And I think there feels like the Biden versus Trump doesn't feel certain to me. I would love to hear your opinion, but I feel like there's, as there has been historically, there's normally some big changes that happen in the lead up to it. So I can't predict them. I don't know what's coming, but it doesn't feel settled to me.
So as we're taping this, March 13th, Trump has a 46% chance to be president, and according to the Smarkets Market, and Joe Biden has a 36.5% chance, which implies there's a 17% chance that Trump or Biden will not be president. My opinion on that is that's crazy. I mean, I assume this is the chance that one of them dies. I guess you have two scenarios. One of them will die, which is not out of the world possibility when you have septuagenarians and octogenarians running for office. But you also have the possibility that Trump might be in jail, I guess, because he has a criminal case coming up starting March 25th. But 17%, it feels way too high for me. I think the markets get this way too much on the other side. And I think there's a trade there to make.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm fascinated by looking at markets. Michelle Obama still 4%. She categorically keeps saying that she's not going to run and not participate. RFK at nearly 3%, who I find, you know, really interesting and compelling, and personally identify with a lot of things that he says, but it's so unlikely for him to actually make it.
Are you an anti-vaxxer?
But I won't go into too many details around that, but I just like that I feel like he upsets the apple cart a little bit. And I find him quite fascinating, but historically has very little chance of having influence. And then Newsom's at 2%. And it just doesn't, all the characters that are at the top of the market, it doesn't make sense to me. And Joe just keeps getting older and older.
Although he looked good on the State of the Union. I don't know if you watched that, but he looked pretty good. I'm interested, I mean, just as an aside, like RFK Jr., like I've listened to probably 2 or 3 hours of him talking on podcasts, and you know, he seems like a nice guy. And I like the idea of upsetting the apple cart. I think people like freshness in politics. I think that's part of the reason why Trump was such a splash, if I can call him a splash, in 2016, because at least he was different. So I definitely give some freshness to RFK Jr. I just think he's got a lot of bad opinions. And a lot of what he says is kind of crackpot stuff. You know, he basically says deep state stuff. He's anti-vax. He's got kind of a lot of conspiracy theories. I guess some of the stuff about being anti-war is not necessarily offensive. It's just I disagree with it. I'm pro-supporting Ukraine, for example. You know, I guess you don't have to get into it if you don't want to, but is there a particular thing that you think like, I wish the leading candidates were pushing this?
No, there's no central theme that I like, but similar to Bernie Sanders' run up to 2016, like I just feel like there's an opportunity to challenge how the whole system's ran, and I would love to see there be some changes there and there not be this sort of two-party controlled environment. But that's very hopeful thinking, and I don't think that's actually going to take place. I don't know. I just feel like the tribalism of the left and the right are, as an independent with no reason to care apart from my kids are American and Australian and we go there often, I just kind of am fascinated by, there being a bit of a change to the system, but it doesn't look like it's happening anytime soon. And I'm just curious to see what happens for both parties and who's running and if there's going to be a late change and something dramatic. To me, it just feels like there's something will change from the Joe versus Donald that we see at the top of the market.
I don't think so, but I'm very curious. I'll be watching, of course, if it does. I totally agree America needs a third party. I think that's part of the reason you get this crazy polarization. Like with two binary polls, it's too easy to listen to the crazies on each side. And I think that's one of the amazing things that Macron did in France, where he kind of carved this like centrist party that, you know, French are kind of against it now, but did so well, winning so much electoral, you know, had a lot of electoral victory with the parliament and did really well there. So I totally agree we need more of a centrist vibe. It's just the electoral college is such a barrier to getting fresh ideas in. And the crazy thing, like Trump didn't have a majority of Americans voting for him. George W. Bush didn't have a majority voting for him. So like, even though we're a democracy, we're picking presidents that the majority of the country doesn't want. That's also like, I think worth mentioning that this electoral college produces really quirky things. Pivoting real quick back to the marketing, as somebody that's been around this industry, as an example critique, what would you say that Smarkets or SBK does badly and we should improve?
I haven't ordered you guys for a while, but I love your data visualization. So I would just lean into, and I've always loved the branding. I think you guys have executed a brand that stands, that is really one of the leaders and has been for as long as you've been running the business. It has an emotional influence to me just because it's so crisp and so clean. And I think that just leaning into that is what I would be doing, particularly around the election, and just trying to use as much data visualizations and be creative. Because, for example, I go to the website electionbettingodds.com, which has amazing
not
SEO
well
juice. Yeah, is horrendously branded. But I remember looking at the search traffic every election period. That website gets just mind-blowing amounts of traffic, like 3-4 million users a month as we heat up. And it's such a poorly executed website that I've always contemplated and wanted to do something better in that space. And I feel like SmartKits is one of the only places that has all the tools, obviously being the real market, as well as having these really crisp branded data visualizations. So I would just be leaning into your strengths as much as possible. I'm not sure if what the main marketing message is at the moment, but if it's exclusively around price and best odds, I feel like there's an opportunity to be a bit more creative there and lean into your product preferences to find some different points of differentiation and leaning into those.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate that. And before we let you go, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Great question. I'm really enjoying having a marketing agency at the moment in our space. I really enjoy what I'm doing. I would love to actually blaze the path of a few of the guests that you've had recently. Then I've got a sports betting related product and a mobile app. I feel like I know exactly how to get it in people's hands in terms of juicing the app store and having it exceed expectations and performances there. I just need the right product. So maybe you and I need to take this offline and come up with something, but I feel like there's still an opportunity to create a global complementary product. I definitely don't want to be an operator or be in that space. The legislative nightmares and barriers to entry are a massive deterrent, but something where I can nimbly offer predictions, for example, on a product that's, you know, NBA predictions or something that's got some data visualizations, some AI, some machine learning in terms of a tool that can help bettors be more educated and take some favorable proven predictions in terms of some recommended betting strategies. That way, I would love to create an application that supports that. So that's what I'd like to be.
I don't think that's going to fit on your fifth grade report about what I want to be when I grow up. But
yeah, it took me 5 minutes to describe it. So I'd like to be an entrepreneur that makes lots of money out of having a complimentary sports betting product.
There you go. All right, James. Well, thanks very much for stopping by and wish you all the best.
Thanks, Jason. You too.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. Learn more about Optimove by requesting a demo at optimove.com/businessofbetting. And if you like what you see, you will get your first month free.